intellectual culture. And to overcome such risks, the Chinese government is defending this as an imaginative venture in ethnic self-improvement. So that Deng Xiaoping, in receiving a regular overseas Chinese visitor, like the American Chinese biologist Niu Manzhang, implies that the main issue in such visits is the rediscovery of the intelligence, as he puts it, of the Chinese people. At the very moment that the Chinese Revolution suddenly seems to require a glorification of the skills and the patriotism of the overseas Chinese, the Vietnamese Revolution, consolidating itself in southern Vietnam, has required the expropriation of the overseas Chinese businessmen in Saigon and elsewhere who controlled much of the old southern Vietnamese economy. So, as I've said, the general strategies of economic and cultural transformation of the Chinese and Vietnamese revolutions can't be detached from the diplomatic relations between Peking and Hanoi. And this is where the two revolutions appear, in a sense, to have collided. China, it is important to note, denies this. The Chinese state, firstly, that more than 95% of the 159,000 overseas Chinese who had been driven out of Vietnam by the middle of July 1978 came from northern Vietnam, not from the south, and that this proves, China says, that they are not predatory businessmen who have been obstructing the installation of collectivism in the Vietnamese south. The Chinese government further argues that, contrary to what both the Vietnamese and the Gang of Four think, the vast majority of the overseas Chinese are not reactionaries, but are workers. The proof of this, according to China Now, is to be found in South China land reform surveys of the early 1950s, which examined the class backgrounds of millions of relatives of overseas Chinese living in South China at the time, and found that very few of them were landlords. Well, needless to say, the Vietnamese can't accept that as definitive proof. My own view is that the overseas Chinese crisis in Vietnam was not premeditated by the Vietnamese government. My own view is that this crisis did begin in the south. Whatever China may claim, that it did begin in South Vietnam as a result of difficulties which the Vietnamese communists suffered in trying to establish their full authority in South Vietnam after 1975. And I think further that the turbulence soon spread to the entire overseas Chinese community in Vietnam, generating uncontrollable ethnic tensions, which have always been latent as the turbulence and the rumors and so on spread. In the old Saigon, now Ho Chi Minh City, when the Americans withdrew in 1975, overseas Chinese merchants had, in effect, their own private banking system. They monopolized certain branches of the export-import industry, and they controlled the supplies of basic commodities like rice, cotton cloth, cigarettes, that sort of thing. The Vietnamese communists, after they took over Saigon, introduced a massive currency exchange blitz in order to get at the old currency holdings, the holdings in the old currency which these businessmen held. They did this in September of 1975 to curb the economic power of these merchants. But the communists, as they admit, lacked the managerial capacity to carry out inventories, let alone confiscations, of the stored goods of these businessmen. And in addition, the new communist rulers of the South were reluctant to demolish quickly a commercial structure which employed hundreds of thousands of people. In the spring of 1978, therefore, 3 years after their military victory, the communists admitted that they controlled, through state-run firms, barely 40% of the retail market for goods in the old South Vietnam. That's their statistic. which is confirmed by what journalists who've been to South Vietnam tell us. So on March 23, 1978, last March, the communists launched what they themselves called a war campaign, Chiến dịch, to break the power of the South's capitalists, many of whom were overseas Chinese, by the expedient of getting all the wage workers who had previously worked for these businessmen, chauffeurs, carpenters, coolies, bricklayers, etc., to inform the state about the hoarded goods which their employers had previously not declared. What followed was an orgy of informing activities right within the street wards of the cities, in which, no doubt, grudges, including ethnic grudges, were also paid off. The government itself of Vietnam said that 90% of the informers' charges about hoarded goods proved to be correct, which means that at least 10% were false. So you can see the nasty sort of situation that could develop. Under these circumstances, the entire overseas Chinese community throughout Vietnam, not just rich merchants, may have stampeded itself into a sort of nervous breakdown. So to conclude, I find it difficult to believe the conspiracy theories which either Peking or Hanoi is offering us about the troubles between them. On the Vietnamese side, I think that Hanoi seriously underestimated China's fear of the Soviet Union. And I think that Hanoi probably thought that after Mao's death, the relationship between the USSR and China would improve. In fact, of course, it has not improved, as you know. But I think that the Vietnamese thought that it would. There's every indication the Vietnamese liked seeing the overthrow of the so-called Gang of Four. So the Vietnamese presumed, I think, that they could remain relatively neutral in the Sino-Soviet dispute, but at the same time receive infusions of technology and modernizing trade from the one source that was willing and capable of supplying it in abundance, namely the communist countries of Eastern Europe and, of course, above all, the USSR. This combination of neutrality in the Sino-Soviet dispute, but economic borrowing from the USSR rather than from the traditional source, China, this combination was a contradiction in Chinese eyes. So it was very dangerous, much more dangerous than Hanoi, I think, calculated. On the Chinese side, I think that Peking seriously underestimated the centuries-old Vietnamese mastery of the art of borrowing from other states, now the USSR, while remaining independent in substance of them. The Vietnamese have done this very well and in the past, and there's no reason to believe they can't continue to do it, especially since they don't share a border with the USSR. So in sum, we are the witnesses of, I think, large-scale diplomatic mismanagement on the part of two of the shrewdest and most experienced neighbor countries on the planet. And it's impossible, this is simply my hypothesis. I cannot go there and tell you whether it is true that 95% of the Chinese who have gone back to China are from the North or not, but on the facts as I have tried to get at them, this is my hypothesis. It might be useful to stop there and have questions.
Thank you.
Professor Woodside has agreed to accept questions. Because it's hard to hear questioners, I would ask that you speak up and make the question short. And I would ask Professor Woodside to repeat the question or the summary of it before answering it. So that he can repeat it, make it reasonably short. We only allow one speaker a night, and tonight it's Professor Woodside.
Right. Professor Woodside, to what extent as an expert in the field did you anticipate mismanagement, and what do you predict for the future?
Whoops. The question was, to what extent did I anticipate the breakdown in diplomatic relations, and what do I anticipate for the future? I did not anticipate it. So it took me by surprise. And as for what is going to happen in the future, well, let's put it this way. Neither of these countries gains from the relations between them as they are in their current state. So that's one thing. Another thing is that I think, in spite of the massive diplomatic mismanagement which I have talked about, I would unhesitatingly say that I think the Vietnamese are the world's best China watchers. They've had to be. Well, to some extent, maybe their position is like our position vis-a-vis the Americans. We try to know a lot about the Americans, far more than they know about us. And certainly the Vietnamese know a good deal about the Chinese. Moreover, because the Vietnamese revolution is being carried out in a society which is in many respects like China's, this gives the Vietnamese a reading on what is going on in the Chinese revolution. So that when the so-called Gang of Four, for example, controlled the Chinese press in the early and middle of the 1970s, the Chinese press was filled with stories about agricultural universities in China being taken over by many sons and daughters of the old Chinese aristocracy, and therefore it was high time to create new agricultural universities for the proletarians. Well, the Vietnamese run agricultural universities in Vietnam against this Confucian background, which they share with China. And as part of the Confucian background, that as Confucius said, the gentleman is not a tool. The gentleman has long fingernails, and he doesn't work with his hands, and he studies the humanities, you might say, and doesn't go to a cow college. As a result of this, the Vietnamese have had a terrible time getting students into their agricultural universities, so much so that until 1969, they didn't even bother to have entrance examinations at Vietnamese agricultural universities because not enough students wanted to get into these universities. So with that background, when the Vietnamese picked up Chinese newspapers and saw the Chinese saying, agricultural universities are being swarmed over by members of the old upper class, they must have known there was something fraudulent about this. So for many reasons, their long history of being close to the Chinese, the fact that they are making a revolution in a country which has many similar circumstances to those of the Chinese, culturally and socially and so on, the Vietnamese are very good, I think, skilled at reading Chinese politics. Yet even they appear to have made a mistake. And so what the future will bring us, it's very hard to say. It will depend to some extent on what's going on in the Vietnamese-Cambodian war, border war, and it's impossible to say. Yes?
Can I ask you a double question?
Sure. In 1977.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any holdover from the spring campaign of this year?
Would
you repeat the question?
Of this year, you mean? That is, did last year's disaster affect what's happening in 1978? The question was about the food supply shortage in Vietnam because of bad harvests and so on in 1977, and the question is, does this affect the Vietnamese today and this crisis? Well, as I've said, the Chinese newspapers have made a lot out of the charge that Vietnamese policemen were drumming up anti-Chinese feelings among Vietnamese workers by saying they're going to eat your rice if we don't get rid of them.
The spring,
by the Americans and so on, and during the war. Well, I'm sure it's had an effect, but a lot of the agricultural problems have been in the north as well as in the south, and some of the southern provinces, like Long An and so on, have actually had good crops in 1977. They themselves have not blamed the herbicide in discussions of the harvest failures as being the number one problem. They've pointed to the bad weather, unpredictable weather, and that sort of organizational problem. But I'm sure it does. Obviously, it would have an effect.
May I ask the second part? Is there no effect of the Russian agents in having a part in agitating?
The question is there no evidence of Russian agents agitating for bad relations between the two countries? Well, this is what the Chinese have said. I find it very hard to believe. That is, I don't find it hard to believe that the Russians would make the effort. They have published a lot of materials on the insidious nature of the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia. The various so-called scholars in the Soviet Union have been publishing tracts about the evil nature of the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia. So in that sense, they might make the effort. But I find it very hard to believe that the Vietnamese would allow them to do this, that the Vietnamese would take it seriously, because the Vietnamese must have reasonably good relations with China, and they don't gain anything from this deterioration. And the Vietnamese are, in my opinion, not... the Chinese think, I think, that the Vietnamese are... sort of in the Soviet camp. I don't think this is true, and I think that the Chinese misunderstand the age-old Vietnamese techniques of appearing to be submissive or at least interested in borrowing from another country while keeping their independence. So that the Vietnamese, for example, in Vietnam's social development, the Vietnamese will hold an exhibit in Hanoi of Russian language works on the great progress of Soviet agriculture, and young Vietnamese are urged to go and read all these books about the great achievements of Soviet agriculture. But in fact, the Vietnamese admire, much more than they say, the Chinese approach to development in the countryside, in which you introduce machines, but you keep these relatively surplus labor, agricultural labor, in the countryside. You don't allow it to migrate to the city. And Vietnamese journals of a scholarly type, which don't circulate very widely in the West, talk about the fact that 24 million peasants fled from the countryside to the cities in the Soviet Union between 1939 and 1959. Or that sort of thing. I'm not sure that is the correct statistic, but Vietnamese journals discuss this sort of thing, and then they praise, in very small print, the Chinese technique of local industries within agriculture, in which the five smalls, as the Chinese call them, where you create small factories and use them to hire peasant labor. So in fact, the Vietnamese are not following the Soviet developmental path that they might suggest as a means of flattering the Russians. I'm fairly certain of that. I think you were first.
Mr. Woodside, can you give us some ideas of the percentage of the population in China that is attending university or technological institutes, and whether this number is increasing or decreasing?
Well, I think it's... Well, it depends on your definition of a university. That is, the people who are currently running China would say that the July 21st workers' colleges and the communist labor colleges and so on, which were very fashionable before 1976, have to be upgraded. They weren't good enough, that sort of thing. On the other hand, a lot of universities that were shut down during the Cultural Revolution are being reopened. I have not seen any statistic in the Chinese press recently which tells us how large the the new class of university students for 1978-1979 is. I think in 1977-1978 it was, well, it was quite a bit. I've forgotten the statistic. I think it was around 300,000 students, but I'm not sure, who were admitted in 1977-1978. And there are, I'm sure, considerable tensions between these new students who have been admitted on the basis of examinations, testing their talent and so on, and the students who are already in the universities who were chosen by other means before 1976. So there's probably a fair amount of tension. We may have some Canadian students who've just come back from China recently who could tell us about this, since they would know about sort of feelings within the university.
Who are the so-called Gang of Four?
Well, they're leaders of the, they're sort of a mixed group of people. They include the wife of Mao Zedong is the most, his last wife is the most notorious, and there are three others, all men. And they have been chosen, they have been vilified. It's very easy to vilify them. Everything we know about Madame Mao would encourage one to think that she had villas in Guangdong and led a fairly good life and felt and liked Greta Garbo movies and felt the masses should not be allowed to see them. And so it's very easy to for them to make her a sort of bad example. Whether this is also indulging in very old Chinese feelings of suspicion against women who are actresses, actors and actresses like barbers and so on were sort of mean people in the old China, I don't know, but she makes a sort of convenient target. But I think that there are many other people besides these four who had very different ideas about the path that China's development should take. Hua Guofeng, the current chairman, estimated last May that 95% of the population of China supported socialism. Well, what that means is that 5% do not. 5% in the country of 800 million people is 40 million, and that's a lot of people to be opposed to socialism, that is, opposed to the government. And added to those 40 million people would be all the people within the party who disagree with the, who followed the, some of the ideas of the so-called Gang of Four and don't like the turnaround to the extent that it is a turnaround.
What is the status of the four today? Do they still have credence?
Do they still have which?
Credence?
What exactly do you mean by credence?
They still
have power. No. No, they don't. There are also, what we have in China now is a sort of interesting mixture. An article appeared in one of the Chinese newspapers recently saying that many of the old cadres resented the Gang of Four because these old cadres who had been with the party back in the Yan'an period in the 1940s, they thought of the party as a family, 35 million people, but they thought of it as a family. And to these old cadres who dislike the Gang of Four, who presume to dislike the Gang of Four because they introduced schisms into the party and said there are many class enemies within the party, when these old cadres thought of the party as a family, to these you would add the intelligentsia, the scientists and so on in China who are happy with the new line. So it's a sort of an incongruous mixture or coalition, if you like, old cadres, excuse me, who have a sort of nostalgic, or nostalgically inclined towards the old days when the party was a struggling family in northern China, and all these scientists and so on who were trained at Caltech or in the Soviet Union in the early 1950s and who have now come back. So it's an interesting combination. Yes.
Professor Woodside, of all the non-Western people that have to learn Western technology,
Japanese did it successfully and on a scale that they have become competitors to do it. Do you have an explanation what it is in the Japanese character history or whatever that makes it different from all the others who failed to do it?
The question is, the statement is that of all the non-Western peoples who tried to adopt Western industrial civilization and do it so well that they became competitors of the West, and in fact better than equal competitors with most Western countries, the only non-Western people who have done this are the Japanese. Do I have any explanation for this in Japanese history or the national character or whatever? Well, that is an enormously controversial question. That's a good way to begin as a scholar. There are some people, for example, some scholars who have thought that you could detect in Tokugawa Japan before 1868 a Japanese equivalent of the Western Protestant ethic, and that this is what enabled the Japanese to do what they did. I myself am very skeptical of this, but there is a school of thought which leans very heavily on that explanation. That's one explanation. Another, in other words, that there were peculiar cultural and even religious forces at work in Japan which enabled the Japanese to outperform the West and certainly outperform other Western, other non-Western countries. These people would also look at education in Japan before 1868 and note that the type of literacy which is inculcated in Japanese schools was peculiarly functional from the point of view of industrial society literacy. In other words, Thailand and Burma, countries like Siam and Burma, also had large literate male populations before the West came. In fact, Burma and Siam had larger, greater degrees of male literacy than England probably did in the early 19th century. But this literacy was not functional from the point of view of industrialization. It was a matter of learning to read some Buddhist texts and so on. But the Japanese schools inculcated a type of literacy which allowed a Japanese industrial takeoff. Okay, that's one explanation. Another explanation would simply be that the Japanese were not buffeted by the West as badly as China was, that Western penetration of China was so extreme that it took the Chinese a tremendous effort just to overcome Western imperial penetration within China, whereas the Japanese, sort of being on the margin, escaped sufficiently in order to get themselves in order. There would be another school of thought in Japan which argues that Japan's modern success story is really a tragedy, that the Japanese have, that many Japanese, especially lower class Japanese, have suffered terribly, have paid a terrible price for this industrialization, and that it's led to a sort of led to militarism in the 1930s, which is obviously very bad and all that sort of thing. And so there are some Japanese historians who, in answering your question, would tell you it was really a tragedy. Of course, there is no explanation that everybody accepts about this. I think what you said is true, but it's hard to explain.
There's time for one more question.
We should reach somebody up.
And there's a person right in the top.
I'm nearsighted.
With a hand up right okay. From the beginning.
Yeah.
Do you have a question of the professor? Please ask it.
Okay. How is it that you've worked as an economist and fearless student such as John K. Fairbanks? How come you've been sponsored by the Warren Rockefeller Foundation? In other words, is it your job as a historian?
What do I actually?
Good idea.
It's getting rather long.
No, the gist of it, I think, is clear to everybody. The question is, I call myself a scholar, so how can I justify having worked with anti-communist and imperialist stooges like John K. Fairbank? And how can I justify having accepted money from the Ford and Rockefeller Foundation? The last fact, by the way, is not correct. I've never accepted money from the Rockefeller Foundation, so let's keep it to the Ford Foundation. I don't think, first of all, of course, I don't think that Mr. Fairbank is an imperialist stooge. I think it's probably correct to say that he is an American liberal scholar who's anti-communist. The only way I can answer the question is by describing my background. I went to Harvard in 1960 as a graduate student because it was impossible in 1960 to do a degree in modern Chinese history at any Canadian university. And I think, for that matter, at any British university, that is a degree in modern Chinese history that would be of any substance. It's incredible to think of it, but as recently as 18 years ago, there were very few places you could go in the Western world to do modern Chinese history. I will admit that after joining the faculty at Harvard, after I got my degree, that on many occasions I felt very uncomfortable about the fact that I was not an American citizen. I was a sort of foreign guest, in a way, in the United States, and it made it very difficult for me to, it didn't make it difficult for me, but it placed me in an awkward position when serious criticism of the Johnson-Nixon policies in Asia became a necessity. And it's partly because of that uncomfortable feeling I had as a foreigner in the United States at a time when American Asian policy, I think, deserved the most devastating criticism it could get. It was because of that I came back to Canada.
Chairman, it is my pleasure and honor to thank a very distinguished member of this university who has given us tonight a very brilliant, penetrating, scholarly, if I may be permitted to say so, historical, and also a psychological analysis of the internal mechanisms that are going on in two rather important countries. When Professor Woodside decided to return to Canada, I was the then Dean of Arts of this university, and I was very pleased that he chose this university. Also, as the president of this university, I think you can see tonight, all of you in this audience, why all of us at this university are very delighted to have such a distinguished person on our faculty. I think his talk tonight fully confirms everything that we all know about Professor Woodside. I hope, Mr. Chairman, the Vancouver Institute has started a very important tradition where year after year we can invite Professor Woodside back to hear about a rather important country, including Vietnam and China, because this university has had a long commitment to the Pacific Rim, and I think we're all very thankful for the brilliant talk we've heard tonight, Professor Woodside. On behalf of the whole audience, I thank you.
Next week, Professor Stevens, also of this university, The Making of a Literature. Thank you.